Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Thorn Mooney is a witch and the High Priestess of Foxfire, a traditional Wiccan coven thriving in the American South. She holds graduate degrees in religious studies and English literature and has worked as a university lecturer, public school teacher, academic journal manager, tarot reader, writer, and musician. Thorn maintains a long-standing YouTube channel, has been blogging about witchcraft and the occult for more than a decade, and is a regular at pagan festivals throughout the United States. Her previous books include Traditional Wicca, A Seeker's Guide, and The Witch's Path, Advancing Your Craft at Every Level. Her most recent book is Taurus Witch, with Ivo Dominguez Jr. Thorn Mooney, welcome to Witchlit.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm super excited to have you on and talk writing. And as I also know, you are a stationery and pen geek, so I'm excited about that. But our first question for everybody on the show is, in this age of all of these ways to communicate, including someone like you who has a YouTube, why still write? Why still write books?
Because it feels good.
That's an excellent answer.
It feels so good. I have tried not doing it a couple of times, and that feels bad. So the words sort of come out. I shifted my journaling a few years ago, too, to where I sort of started dumping everything into a single book and not trying to categorize it or think about why I was writing or what it was doing or blah, blah, blah. And just doing it because it felt good, like physically and mentally good. So yeah, and I write more when I just kind of let it go like that. So that's why I still write books.
No, that's a great answer. So before you dumped everything into one notebook, did you have a notebook for different topics? Like you had like, this is my work stuff. This is what I'm reading. This is witchcraft. Did you have it all kind of separated out in different notebooks?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. When I, my very first, maybe it wasn't my very first, but at least my first couple books was To Ride a Silver Broomstick by Silver Ravenwolf. And she has this chapter called Magical Record Keeping, where she gives you a list of all of the tabs that you might consider putting in your binder as you're starting to study witchcraft. And I had no chill and took everything very literally. So I made a tab for every single thing on her massive list, many of the things which I have still never looked at or learned about or thought about ever again from that book. So yeah, and then as I got a little bit older and discovered the magic of stationery, I was like, well, this is just an excuse to have more notebooks. So it expanded from a binder into just lots and lots of tabbies, which I also did not use. It turns out getting older does not change that.
Yeah. I don't know. I think I'm a little older than you. So I, to ride a silver broomstick, I read, but I was already like in my 20s when it came out. And I had been doing witchcraft for a while by then, but I have never been able to do the binder thing. Like aesthetically, it just bothered me, which is so weird.
Oh yeah.
Like I was just like, it's plastic and like I couldn't do it. So I've always been like a bound notebook kind of person.
That's who I am now. I wouldn't use a binder now, but when I was in, I guess it would have been late middle school, early high school, the binder was the way to go. And every kid had a binder because you used them in school. I don't think my parents would have gotten me like a hard bound blank book. They would have thought that was too fancy for a child.
When did you start? When did you really start getting into witchcraft and how old were you?
I mean, I think I have one of those stories that a lot of folks have where I had inclinations when I was younger. Like I remember very distinctly buying a pentacle necklace at a head shop in like the fifth grade in Old Town Alexandria. And I remember buying it because I was with another girl in my class and it scared her. And I thought that was funny. So I would wear it to school, like, and I didn't think anything of it, right, as a child. I mean, the Time Life, Mysteries of the Unknown books, I had those. So I knew that witchcraft was a thing that was out there. I don't think that it really occurred to me as a thing that, like, I could do or, like, people who I, like people in my life could potentially do. It was an interest, but it really wasn't until the tail end of middle school, the first year of high school, when a girlfriend gave me a copy of Teen Witch by Silver Ravenwolf and Wicca, Guide for the Solitary Practitioner by Cunningham. And I read To Ride a Silver Broomstick kind of in that same batch, probably within a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was when I would say that it really started, when I was thinking about practice and as being something that could be mine.
Yeah. I know, it's so interesting because, like, there's the whole, like, late Xer, I hate to say older millennial because it sounds weird to me, but older millennials.
Yeah,
older millennials, like that whole 90s window of witchcraft to me is just fascinating. Because, I mean, I think it, you know, I look at all the stuff we have now, comparatively speaking, and how many people walked through those same, like, few doors into witchcraft.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were not a whole lot of doors at the time. Or maybe there were, but we certainly wouldn't have had access to them.
No. I mean, I was in rural East Tennessee. Yeah. Where was I going to find
them? There's no Facebook you can get on. And there wasn't even the Witch's Voice until 1999, right? So we didn't even have that.
I do think it's funny, though, the Time Life books, because we also had a set of those. My parents are really into Time Life books, and we had The Mysteries of the Unknown. And I also was obsessed with Leonard Nimoy's In Search Of on television. Oh, yeah. So, yeah.
I also watched Unsolved Mysteries, right? Mm-hmm. And every now and then they would have, like, a paranormal episode. And, of course, The X-Files was out, too. I think that was, like, 93 or 94, wasn't it? It was early-ish 90s. Yeah. And I was obsessed with that show. So there was just the 90s, you know, I think... We were all afraid of the governments. We were like, it's aliens and monsters.
It's aliens and monsters. Oh, wait. It turns out it was witches all along.
Turns out it was capitalism all along.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, cool. Well, we could probably talk pop culture forever. But I also, like, I have questions because I have been following your YouTube for a long time and your blog. And so I know that you start writing longhand.
I do.
And it blows my mind that there are people who do. I mean, I know, like, Neil Gaiman does it too. So you're, like, in really good company. And I usually start, but after, like, the first chapter, I go into panic mode that's the only version. And so then I start typing. But so what prompted that for you?
Actually, what prompted me was learning that Neil Gaiman writes longhand. I'm serious. Like, I think I read that on Twitter or something. Mm-hmm. And I was like, hey, maybe it could be fun. Like, that could be cool. I could pretend I was Charles Dickens or something. I don't know. And I got myself a notebook, and wouldn't you know it, it really did help. It turns out that I have a lot of anxiety around computers that I didn't know about. Mm-hmm. And I discovered that once I decided to try, like, my longer project by hand. I write my school papers that way now. I pretty much do everything that way, unless it's, like, a throwaway something.
So how does that work for you for editing? So is, like, the transcription to, is that kind of like your first draft edit then?
Exactly. Yeah. So the handwritten version, I guess, is that's the first draft, really. Mm-hmm. That's the manuscript. And then when I'm transcribing it, people ask if I use like voice to text or whatever. And no, and I don't, because this is the first opportunity to edit and proofread. So when I am reading it, and the transcription process is really slow, at least if I want to not insert additional typos, and it's important that it be slow, because I'm also spending a lot of time with each sentence and all of my word choices. And it gives me the opportunity to go, oh, I used the same word three times in the sentence, or like my verb is in the wrong tense, or this sentence is really garbled. Like, when I read it back to myself, I'm not sure what I'm saying. Can it be two sentences instead of one? So the transcription is the first edit, which means that it takes me at least 312 times longer, I think, than any other person to write a book. but my time with, like, copy editing is almost nil, because by the time I'm turning in a manuscript, I've already caught not everything, but I've caught an awful lot. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. That works. No,
I like that. Yeah, I think in that same thing where he talked about writing longhand, he also talks about his obsessions with fountain pens.
Oh, yeah.
So,
I don't recommend writing longhand for extensive periods of time with a ballpoint, because ballpoints, you guys didn't know that you were here to listen to somebody talk about pens instead of witchcraft, right? I swear.
I've wanted to talk to you about pens for so long, so I'm really excited. Hopefully everybody else will be too.
I promise this is related to magic, everybody. But ballpoints require you to put pressure on the pen. So it hurts your hand. It hurts everybody's hand. So if you're writing for a long time and you're like, oh, writing is so, like, it's hurting. It's because ballpoint pens are garbage. Throw them away. I bought a fountain pen because a girlfriend of mine was really into them. And she was using one day. And I was like, oh, that's really cool. Can I try it? And she thought it was nuts that I wasn't already into fountain pens, because she thought that clearly I had the personality for it. And I was like, well, you know, I've thought about it, but I'm a collector, and I'm, you know, I have a tendency to like hoard a little bit. So I don't know that I need one more hobby. And she was like, do it. So I bought a pen. And I think I had like 12 of them in the first like few months. But yeah, fountain pens work by capillary action. So the paper actually like pulls the ink out of the feed. So you're not putting any pressure on your hand. It's great.
Yeah. I think people who've never written with them, it takes a while to figure that out, and you tend to mash. Yeah. But, to me, I mean, I think the magic in fountain pens, one thing, I love the history of them. I mean, and to me, that's kind of magical, but, like I will confess that I too have quite a collection, and I have a different pen for every day, and it has its own ink for that day. And then I also have magical ink that I only use in certain pens when I'm writing in my book of shadows or writing spells. So yeah, I mean, you can go as deep as you want, I think, with the magic of them too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you're interested in any kind of magical work surrounding color, right? I mean, or if you do any sort of like petition magic or anything involving paper or writing in any form, if you're an artist or a writer yourself or whatever, but being able to control the kind of ink that you use and its qualities, and watching how that shifts with the kind of paper that you use, that just introduces a lot of options into your magical work. So some witches are really enthusiastic about, you know, like rocks and plants and whatever. And I collect fountain pen ink, and I do a lot with ink and paint, and, that's what gets me excited.
Yeah, me too. No, I love fountain pen ink. And the thing I think is interesting is, again, like there's the whole thing about making your own ink, which I've tried a couple times with limited success. I don't know that I'm an ink maker as much as I am an ink user, but I do like the idea of like making your own like walnut hull ink and things like that for special purposes. Like, I think you get like this rabbit hole goes deep, and depending on how much of a collector you are, it can also go real expensive. So,
yeah. What's cool is I've made things like walnut ink before. You can also make ink out of pokeweed, which is this really kind of like rich red brown color. But even if you don't want to make ink from scratch, just being able to doctor it magically. So I've definitely used herbs and oils in ink. You can use stones to charge it the same way you would water. Just kind of as a caveat, you do want to be careful what sort of ink you're putting in your fountain pens. Most of them aren't made for this sort of thing. I actually keep a glass dip pen or a quill pen for when I am doing cuckoo bananas stuff with ink.
Same.
So something for listeners to be cautious of. Don't just put anything liquid in your pen.
Yeah, no, it'll especially ones like with metal barrels, it'll ruin them pretty quick. I did learn how to cut a quill pen with a pen knife.
Nice.
I wanted to like be authentic about it.
Yeah, you could do that at bars and pick people up.
There you go. Well, I'm probably not at this point in my life. I'm probably past the point of picking up people in bars. I would entertain them, but they don't need to come home with me. That's fine. So,
as long as they're impressed with your quill cutting skills.
That's right. Exactly. So when you are starting a new project, like, I'm trying to imagine like the balance of you writing books while you're also in grad school. Like that seems really stressful to me. So like when you have a new project, like I'm assuming you wrote the stuff for TorSwitch while you're in grad school.
Yes.
Based on the timing. So how do you balance all that and kind of separate those things?
I try to double dip. If I am thinking about something really intently for a class or I've got some kind of academic project in mind, I always ask myself if it's translatable into which spaces, just because that's a lot of what I'm thinking about. I'm in religious studies and I do a lot with religion and social media, religion and marketing, conversion. I do something called ethnography, which is basically, they used to call it participant observation, where you go and you hang out with groups and you learn about them and you write about them. And I don't study witches and pagans and occultists explicitly. But I mean, I am self-interested and these are my communities. So a lot of the questions that I'm asking about religion broadly as a category, I'm thinking about because of my time in magical spaces. So one of the ways I keep, you know, kind of, I guess, productive and occupied in both arenas is I see where they overlap, and they overlap quite a bit. I also just, I think I have a lot of allowances in my time that I think typical graduate students don't have. I have a partner who works, which means that I don't have the same kind of stresses that a lot of my much younger peers have, right? They're really busy figuring out paying rent and roommates and all kinds of other stuff. My home life is much more stable. So I just have a lot less to freak out about, which means I have more time to write. I also work full time, and because I'm also an author, I don't have to do things like chase fellowships and funding. My program is funded, but it doesn't cover, you know, living expenses and conference travel. A lot of that sort of stuff I have to do myself. But I have that income, so I'm actually like doing less than like most 25-year-old graduate students.
Mm-hmm. So is your long-term goal to be in academia or to write for the public?
I definitely don't want to be in academia, which definitely gets me some weird faces in school. I get a whole lot of, well, why are you here then? To which my answer is much the same with writing books. I just like it. And if somebody else is going to fund my being there, I'm really excited to go to school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think a lot of people don't think about doing things like that in particular for pleasure. But I have the opportunity to do so, and it's what I like. But my intention has never been to work in academia. I think it's mostly a gigantic, very scary pyramid scheme. And it seems like very obviously a bad idea in the year 2023, especially in the humanities.
Yeah, I was gonna say, it's not a much return on investment if you're interested in that sort of thing.
No, it's just objectively a bad idea, at least from a financial perspective. From a personal perspective, by all means, but financially, it's just kind of goofy.
Yeah.
So I want to write for the public. A big part of the appeal of pursuing the PhD was having kind of, aside from the education itself and the opportunity to just be allowed to think and kind of professionally play with ideas, that's a credential that we really don't have a ton of in our community. I think we have more than people realize. But I wanted the authority to be able to say, like, no, actually, I have this credential. And just because I think when you are any sort of magical practitioner, you know, in the 90s, we were really worried about people thinking that we were devil worshipers. And, you know, sometimes we are devil worshipers, LOL. But I think in 2023, the thing that you actually need to be worried about most of the time is everybody you encounter just thinking that you are very, very stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that always really bothered me.
Yeah. Yeah, which to me seems so funny because I think even like the, because I really started practicing when I was at university for my undergraduate. And so all the people I practiced with were also at like that was never my perception because all the people I knew who were into witchcraft were smart people, you know, they were at least in school. I mean, maybe we weren't all smart because we were in college, but we were at least trying to be smart, right? So I think that was never my perception. So and I remember reading that in your book about like this perception of how could you be a witch? You don't look stupid, you know, that kind of thing. It's like, it just seems so weird to me, I guess.
Yeah.
But I also get it and I have seen it in action, but it's so not connected to my experience as a witch in the world. So
that's funny. Yeah. I wonder how much of that is regional or class-based or like what that is. Cause I definitely heard a lot of variation in what people experience when they talk about being a witch. But my experience broadly has been that people either think that I am like intellectually unsound, or they think that I'm like emotionally damaged or something, right? Like the word people would use is crazy. That's not a word that I'm a fan of using. Right. But there's this idea that like, well, if you think magic is real, you know, are you one of those people who also thinks that the earth is flat and you don't listen to science and you're just some fanciful person who didn't grow up and you want like those kinds of things.
And then I think of all the witches I know who are like actually scientists.
Right.
You know, like
literally,
like, it clearly is their perception, but you know, I don't know. Like, it's just so weird to me because like I said, you're right. There are a lot of people in our community who have PhDs. I've interviewed a lot of them on the show. You know, like it doesn't seem that unusual to me. But I do wonder, like, you know, I think in this kind of golden age of publishing that we're in, like there is, I mean, there's a lot of publishing for, you know, the masses. It's not really a word I want, but like lay people, I guess, people who are actually practicing, right?
And general then, like, audiences,
right? With like Llewellyn and Wiser and all these smaller publishers and stuff. And I mean, my own publishing house, that's what we're publishing to you. And then there are academic presses. There are people studying these things academically. Mm-hmm. And so depending on where you want to read, you have a lot of space. But I do wonder if some of what is happening in academia that would be of interest to general audiences. I mean, we know there's a paywall for journals that a lot of people can't access. And may not know how to access the author to just say, hey, by the way, can you send me your article? But I wonder like what the dividing line is there. And if you've seen that like in your studies now, kind of like the access to that academic stuff for people who aren't in academia or haven't been in academia.
Totally. And that's a big part of the reason why I want to do what I want to do. I'd like to be one of those bridges. I'd like to have the internal authority to be like, yes, I belong in the ivory tower, but then the groundedness to actually communicate with my real life communities that I love. And that that paywall is there for a reason. And I think we can talk later about getting around that, by the way, happy to help.
And the paywall doesn't benefit the people who do the writing, by the way, in case anyone didn't know that the writers aren't getting that money.
Academic piracy is often fine. we can talk about that later too. But that paywall is there on purpose. It's there to keep information away from people and to kind of reinforce these sorts of class divides. And I think that a lot of practitioners don't realize just how much academic work is being done. There are a lot of things in our communities that people act like it's a mystery and we'll just never know. But actually, like, academics have been talking about it for X many years or whatever, right? Like, we have an awful lot of information about the histories of our various traditions, right? There's a lot of things that aren't particularly mysterious anymore. But we just don't, I mean, a lot of these this kind of information just doesn't make it into books for the general population, whether that's the kind of theological work that's happening in other sorts of religious communities, or how we think about leadership and community and how power works and how groups organize. Like, there's so much information out there that I think would be of really deep interest to all kinds of occultists, but they just don't have access and they don't know that it's out there.
Yeah. I mean, I guess we can talk about that now. Like, how would you recommend people access this? I mean, I know there's free ways to do it, but I don't know that everybody knows those free ways.
Totally. I think that the hardest thing for folks is not so much even the access. It's about what it is that they're even looking for. Because if you roll on into like your public library and you are just in a like a virtual card catalog and you type in the word witchcraft, that's not going to bring up academic stuff. Okay. Most of the time. So what you want to do is think about like specifically what it is that you want to learn or what you're interested in. And if you're not, think about regions and time periods or individuals. Like, let's say that I was really, really curious about Robert Cochran. Okay. And like, I'd heard this name a whole lot, maybe on TikTok, traditional witchcraft communities, but I didn't know anything about Robert Cochran. And a lot of the books that were put out that were more accessible or out of print right now, right? Capelban isn't around anymore. So a lot of the books about Robert Cochran, you just can't get anymore. But if I have access to, you could use like Google Scholar. A lot of folks don't realize that Google has this whole other side to it. If you were to type Robert Cochran in a Google Scholar search, rather than like your regular Google or on TikTok or on Wikipedia or whatever, you're not going to get, you know, these like blurbs and videos. You're going to get academic articles that have been published in peer-reviewed journals about Robert Cochran. So maybe you turn up, Ethan Doyle White has an article about him. I know this because I was just citing it in the book I'm working on right now. Ethan Doyle White has an article that came out in 2011 in volume 3 of The Pomegranate. Okay. And maybe I've never heard of The Pomegranate, but I find out that it's a pagan studies journal. And I go look at their website and guess what? They have a whole list of all the different kinds of people who published with them. And you can go and you can look at who all is doing this work. And that's how you figure out what realm of people and publications to look for. You'll find that there are academic journals that focus on specific disciplines like anthropology or religious studies or sociology or whatever. If you can find the name of journals, you can go to the journal website. Many of them publish what's called open access, which means that the authors or the academic societies pay additional fees so that the articles are freely available instead of behind a paywall. You'd be surprised how much you can get through open access. So I would start there. And then you can, if you have access to a university library, which college students do. And if you are an alumnus of a college, you might still also have access, even though you've graduated. But if you go to your university library, you can look up academic journals again, and you should have access to pretty much everything unless your college is really, really underfunding its library.
Which happens, unfortunately. But
yeah. Totally. And once you have a list of names, I mentioned Ethan Doyle White, like, okay, like this person's written a whole lot. Like, I'm going to keep an eye on him. You get on social media on Twitter or on this website called academia.edu and you look up Ethan Doyle White and you follow him, you know? And most academic authors are not being paid royalties on journal article publications, which means that there's no skin in the game as far as them sharing their work. It takes a lot of time to write and publish an academic article. I promise they want you to read it. So you can, a lot of scholars, you can drop them a note on social media or on academia.edu. And you can just ask them and many of them will send you a PDF. And barring that, find yourself a friend at a college somewhere and ask them to look it up for you.
Yeah. And I will give one other tidbit for people, like as a fiction author, if you say you're researching a book, people will talk to you for hours about any topic you want to know anything about.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're actually interested in what they have to say. And a lot of people don't get to experience that.
Yeah, that's a good one. You can even use that as a template. If it's awkward, randomly tweeting at or emailing somebody you don't know, it's okay to lie sometimes. I'm writing a paper.
You know, just say, I'm really interested in this.
Yeah.
If you don't want to lie, you can just say, I'm really interested in this and I haven't found anyone who can tell me this piece of information.
Yeah.
So, yeah. No, people love to talk about what they nerd out about.
Totally.
Yeah. I have built an entire podcast on it.
Yeah. I just lectured your audience for a solid 10 minutes about academic publishing. And before that, we were talking about fountain pens.
It was beautiful. And I do love that for people who haven't gone to academia.edu, I do love the chat feature for that you can, especially if you download a paper, they'll give you the option to tell the author why you downloaded it. And as a writer, and I'm sure you can echo this, having someone tell you why they're interested in your work or that they're excited to read your work is not necessarily better than a royalty check, but it's really close and sometimes better, maybe.
Yeah. Well, the royalty check isn't guaranteed.
Right.
So the compliment is sometimes more precious moment.
Yeah. No, reach out to authors you love. They trust me. I mean, as long as you're not weird about it.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a good thing. Oh, so like I was thinking about, like, I know, I always feel a little weird about this because like I follow you on Instagram. So it feels slightly stalkery to say, hey, I know you were in England recently ish.
Yeah.
And got to see a certain Dr. Ronald Hutton speak.
Oh my God.
So I might have fangirled on your behalf reading that.
Oh, yeah.
Would you like to chat about that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think Jason Mankey took a picture of me, I think kind of like hovering in the background, just like sort of trying to discreetly fangirl from a safe distance and visibly failing. I have photographic evidence. Yeah. He's like signing a book for somebody else and I'm just like being creepy 5 feet away. Yeah.
Oh, nice. That was for what, for the new book, right?
Yes. The title, I'm blanking on the title. But yes,
I have it on the shelf, but I have my reading glasses on, so I can't read it from here.
Yeah. It's not Queens of the May. Queens of the Wild.
Queens of the Wild. There you go.
Yes. Yeah, there we go. I was like, that's wrong.
So
amazing.
Yeah. And I think of him as someone, I mean, he is an academic writer and a lot of his stuff is dense for people who aren't used to academic writing, but he's also not impenetrable as an academic writer. Like, I don't think he has that, you know, there are academic writers whose vocabulary and diction make it almost impossible to figure out what they're trying to say. He is not one of those.
Yeah, they do that on purpose.
Yeah, he's not one of those. Like, having been in the English department, I can tell you that that's like a whole thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he is not one of those academic writers. Those people exist, but he's not one.
Yeah, I have a lot of feelings about that also.
Same.
But Hutton is, I think, more accessible than he looks. Just sitting in the big, heavy volume on the shelf.
Yeah.
He definitely has a sense of humor about him. And I would say if you were trying to tackle Hutton for the first time, just to cut yourself some slack, because it's a different genre of writing and it will take some adjustment. It's like reading like Jane Austen for the first time or something, or Shakespeare for the first time. Give yourself a lot of time and a lot of space. And when you get frustrated, like, it's okay to go back and like read the passage again. Everybody does.
Yeah.
I also made a Ronald Hutton's Triumph of the Moon reading guide. If anybody is hard up, put my classroom skills to work there for a book club that I was running.
Oh, nice.
So it's a challenge, but it's well worth it. A lot of the things that people fight about, especially on TikTok, especially like younger folk is really what I mean. I don't say that disparagingly, like I'm on TikTok too. But a lot of the things that younger folks argue about, it's stuff that they don't know that they think people haven't solved. And I'm like, no, Hutton wrote about this in 1998, actually.
Yeah, no, it's, we have it. We have this book that all of us who came up in the Burning Times era got access to and were like, oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's more than Hutton too. I think Hutton is his own, you know, his own kind of trailblazer there too in academic spaces, just because there really wasn't, I mean, there were pagan studies, was kind of becoming a thing. There were certainly scholars who were interested in writing about paganism, witchcraft, magic, they call it like Like those folks were out there. But I mean, what Hutton did, I mean, and he'll tell you himself, if you listen to him in interviews, or if you ever have the pleasure of seeing him lecture, that was something that was really, I mean, dangerous actually, like for his career, you know. I mean, coming out in academic spaces, there's definitely a stigma against studying things that people perceive as being like kooky or weird mm-hmm. or evil or whatever. I can't imagine what it was like to go through that in the 90s when he was researching and writing and publishing this work. But I've been through, you know, I've been through a religious studies department in the 2000s, and like it still isn't fun. Like people still think that you're wasting your time, or like, well, you're not going to have any writing opportunities because not enough people care about that, right? And if you're just like, I think there are more pagans than there are like Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses, right? Like, can we stop pretending that it's not a significant thing in the American religious landscape, please? Mm-hmm. But there's still kind of a stigma to studying that sort of thing. And for him to put out Triumph of the Moon in the 90s, like that was a big deal. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I'm not surprised by the stigma, because I mean, we all know the stuff that goes on. Excuse me, the cat mm-hmm. needs attention. But the idea that studying paganism or witchcraft or occult topics is somehow more kooky than studying any other religious practice, to me, like, I can't wait till we get past that, I guess.
Oh, yeah. You know? Right. Like, I really don't understand the way, like, people are asking me if I'm okay when I'm like some of you people asking believe in bodily resurrection. Like, why? I don't understand why what I'm doing is strange. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, why is that? Why is that different? But it is, and, you know, or has been perceived that way. So I think we can just like, hope that continues to pass.
This is really strange. It's like, yes, I'm ascribing like spiritual significance to this tree, but like, you think that your God hears all of your thoughts. Like, why is that normal?
Well, and I think we're there is this idea weird. That, I think nobody would say to, well, I mean, there are people who would, but most people would not say to someone going to like seminary or divinity school, like, why? Like, why are, you know, are you an intelligent person if you're doing that? Mm-hmm. But if you tell them, I don't know, you're going to Cherry Hill Seminary to be a pagan social worker, they look at you like you've lost your mind. So.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I think some of it is like Christian hegemony, right? Like, we have this idea that if it looks like, especially Protestantism, if it looks like Protestantism, then it's safe and it's legitimate and it's reasonable, and everything else is people being, you know, unhinged. But I think some of it, especially in the United States, in recent decades, is also a general kind of, think about like the new atheists, this very kind mm-hmm. of like anti-religion as a whole thing that's happening, mm-hmm. Where, you know, everybody gets thrown under the bus. And a lot of it is like people are angry at particular kinds of evangelicals. Mm-hmm. Okay. So they assume that when somebody is religious, they resemble this particular kind of evangelical, and they throw everybody in the bus, you know, under the bus with them. And that gets messy and terrible really quickly. So I think mm-hmm. we've got both of those things to deal with, like Protestant normativity, but then also this weird sort of like anti-religiosity thing that's happened recently.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, you know, being so anti-religion is its own dogma at some point. Like, you just
totally
met the horseshoe kind of thing.
It's totally like,
whatever. I don't know, I tend to whatever those people. I can't take them any more seriously than I can the fundamentalist person who can't think anyone else can have an idea about anything. It feels the same to me.
Totally. What's always funny to me too is I think a lot of folks don't realize that like religious studies scholars study those groups too, in the same way that we mm-hmm. study like openly religious groups. A big part of what I work on is the idea of secularism and why people think that secularism is a thing. Mm-hmm. Like, that's something that religion scholars, you know, look at. But I think everybody thinks that we just pick our favorite religion and that's what we study forever, you know?
Like, no, it's not how it works. Well, and I think, you know, there's so much, like, I tried as an undergrad to major in comparative religions. Unfortunately, the university I was at, everything was on demand and I would have taken like 10 years to graduate. And yeah. I was like, I can't do this. I don't have time or the money. But yeah, like so much of what we look at, especially like in a culture in the United States where you have religions butting up against each other all the time. I mean, it's just that to me is more fascinating in some ways than just diving deep forever on one topic. Like my brain doesn't work that way.
So. Oh, totally. Ultimately when it comes down to it, I study power and like how power moves mm-hmm. and how like religion is a political category. It's not just about like what people think about God. It's a political entity in the United mm-hmm. States, and it impacts how people live their lives, and it impacts how we govern. And that's a big part of what I care about. So it's reductive to think about like, oh, like she just is really passionate about witches. You know, it's like, well, yeah, but that's because these things that impact Christian communities also impact Wiccan and pagan and mm-hmm. witch communities and occultists. Like we do a lot of the same things that these other groups do.
Yeah.
And
are sometimes actually being persecuted, but you know, that's right. That's a whole different topic. The one thing another thing I want to ask you about kind of in this academic realm is, I can't remember when, because, you know, source amnesia of the modern world, but you talked pretty extensively, I think, in a YouTube video, and I think it also showed up partly on TikTok, about who we cite, you know, like in mainstream books and in academia. Wanted to ask you about it, partly because I knew you were passionate about it, but partly because mm-hmm. it's something that I think about in my own writing mm-hmm. about like who are the go-tos and why mm-hmm. and how do we change that paradigm, I guess.
Yeah. This is a hill I'm constantly crawling on to die on. Yeah. And it's easy to misunderstand, because I think that when people hear me, most of the time I'm just like bitching, right? Like when people hear me upset about this, a lot of folks interpret it as me saying that men outnumber everybody else in witchcraft spaces, and like men are the problem and blah, blah, blah. And like, that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm not arguing in the least that like there aren't 7 billion women, right? Like in this community, like, yeah, this kind of like, there's a particular sort of femininity that gets attached to witchcraft. Mm-hmm. And it's often a particular presentations of femininity that end up being the face of witchcraft, right? And I've absolutely talked to men in particular who feel excluded by that, who feel like there isn't space for them. You'll see a lot of like, you know, well, men are witches too kind of stuff on the internet. Right. So I'm not saying that, you know, that isn't the case, right? Like men objectively, like numerically are in the minority. That's right. True. But numbers don't equate to authoritative power.
Right.
Which I think like we all know that, or we should know that. Just because women are outnumbering men, just because everybody else is outnumbering men, right? That doesn't mean that that's where the authority lives. And all you have to do to test that is look at the books on people's recommended reading lists. Look at, like, roll on over to like Llewellyn or Wiser and see who the best-selling books are by. Not the ones that are best-selling right this minute. I mean the best-selling ones over the course of decades. Mm-hmm. Which books are printed over and over again? Which books always seem to be on the shelf? Which books make it onto the recommended reading list handed to you by, you know, coven leaders or in the beginning or the end of other books? And overwhelmingly, those books are by men. I mean, think about the books that people are always talking about, right? Like Buckland's Big Blue Book, Wicca, Guide for the Solitary Practitioner. People rant about Gerald Gardner, right? Like you don't hear people talking about Patricia Crowther, right? Like you don't hear people talking about mm-hmm. Doreen Valiente. You don't hear people talking. I mean, like, and the books that we malign over time, right? Like people on TikTok are still really mad about like everything Silver Ravenwolf published in the 90s, right? She's not doing anything differently than like a Scott Cunningham or a Ray Buckland. But the level of vitriol is so, it's marked, it's really apparent. And I think that that's misogyny. And it's not like it's individual men sitting there and like twiddling their thumbs and thinking about how they can like ruin the community. Of course, I don't think that. But there's this kind of assumption we have about where the authoritative voice is. And we just see it demonstrated over and over again that, you know, a man says something and it can be authoritative. When any other gender says something, then it's not. We have to question it, right? Like, who is this person? You know, what's their background? Well, how do we know? So that's my objection.
And I think like with the Silver Ravenwolf books in particular, you know, like I really wish people would move off that particular hobby horse. But I also associate it with how much we denigrate what teenage girls like.
100%. Yeah. We really just don't like it when teenage girls like stuff, you know, whether it's Taylor Swift or Silver Ravenwolf or like whatever, the color pink, like whatever thing it is. If young girls and young women like it, we think it's stupid.
Yeah.
I think that's a big part of why people don't like Wicca even today. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's plenty of reasons to not like Wicca, but I think that one of the big ones is actually misogyny, whether it's internalized misogyny or just outfit. Like we associate it with particular kinds of people. We associate it with young women. I think that's a big part of what's going on.
Well, and I wonder too, like with Wicca, I mean, and I don't know that we're 100% past the Wicca bashing era, but in the height of that, I'm like, but do you know anybody who's an initiated Wiccan? Like, I mean,
right.
I didn't meet any until I was like in my 30s.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I met a lot of solitary Wiccans and eclectic practitioners, but I met one initiated Gardnerian or Alexandrian who'd grown up in a family who were Alexandrians. That was it. Like for the first 15 years, I considered myself a witch.
Yeah. And I think we saw that we're definitely not out of like the anti-Wicca thing. Like that's something that I see on TikTok more than anywhere else.
Yeah.
And again, like there are lots of really legitimate reasons to criticize Wicca. This is not me saying that like, oh, poor Wiccans. Okay. Like, but a lot of the things that people are mad about just aren't very accurate.
Or have been dealt with.
Right, like the number of times that I've had like a 19-year-old say something to me like, you know, Margaret Murray was wrong. And I'm like, do you? but there was something that happened in witchcraft spaces like 10 years ago, too. Tell me if you remember this, where like one of the things that we were really disparaging about Wicca was this idea of like this gentle maiden mother crone goddess. Right. And like this very femme presenting, very like soft, nurturing ethics, right? Ooh. And at the same time, there were a lot of traditional witchcraft books that were coming out that were like, the goddess is, she's a whore, right? Like sacred Babylon, blah, 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 like dark mother, scary, right? Like there was a whole lot of literature about how like the goddess in Wiccan spaces was just like too gentle and nice and sweet, and Wiccans didn't have a backbone and blah, blah, blah. And then like the foil we got in other witchcraft spaces was like dark, slutty, magic, hardcore, blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, both of these are misogyny. Like both of these are just, this is like virgin whore stuff, guys, right? Do we need to go back to freshman literature?
Yeah. It's like we've done that. Like if you've ever like studied English literature, right. Like
somebody please meet a woman, anybody.
Yeah, it's like go listen to that Meredith Brooks song.
I like the TikTok edit though, right? Where it's just, she's, I'm a bitch, I'm a bitch, I'm a bitch, I'm a bitch. Right. That's the canonical version now.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I'm like, it's funny to me. And I do think, I think there have always been trends, right? And I think social media has probably sped those up to some extent. And like they cycle through really fast. I mean, I feel like I've also kind of removed myself from social media spaces a little bit. Like I kind of do what I have to, but I don't spend a lot of time there just for my own mental health. But it seems like I'm seeing less when I do dip in. The thing is, maybe like 2 years ago, I don't know, COVID's messed up time for me, where it's like, oh God, don't read books. You know, like, don't read a book. Like, yeah. All of these authors are problematic. And I'm like, welcome to literature.
Yeah.
I mean, where have you been? Like, we've all been here.
So. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, I remember that too. There was a period where I swear like every, and you know, we make fun of TikTok, but this happens on Facebook too.
Oh,
this happens this happens everywhere. This is not like a single platform.
Mm-hmm.
But there was definitely this period where like there was a blacklist going around every week. Like there was like, just come on. But yeah, I really do feel like there is an anti-intellectual current in magical spaces.
Mm-hmm.
I think that people, and I mean, like, you know what, there are definitely reasons to be like suspicious of certain kinds of media, right? And this isn't to say that like every book is good and reliable, whereas every website is not. But yeah, I do feel like there was this idea that you couldn't trust books and you couldn't trust authors.
Mm-hmm.
And the solution was to look within, right? Like, and follow your intuition and learn from each other instead of reading books. And like, you can actually do both of those things. Like, if you want to read books, you can read them. And
yeah. Like, and actually some books tell you that's what you should do. Like, yeah, they're not mutually exclusive.
Yeah. All of the stuff that y'all are just like now discovering for the first time on Witch Talk is stuff that like we were talking about in books 10 years ago.
Like, well, and I mean, I think that anti-intellectual bent, unfortunately, extends far beyond the witchcraft community. Like, I think that's like an American,
American
trend.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which I, you know, that's a whole another podcast probably. But I do try to keep it to an hour, though I think we're going to fail today. But I did want to give you the opportunity to kind of plug what's coming for you and, you know, what's just come out, what's on the horizon. I can tell you when it's going to air, which is probably further away from today than you think it is. just because we record in big batches, which people will now know, which I don't think I've ever actually said on the mic.
So now you know
that we record like a month. This will air mid-October. So
everything I publish was written multiple years before it was published, because that's how media works.
Right. So if you want to let know what you'll do in this fall, what's coming up for you, and then we'll go into our game of chance question.
Yeah. I am working on a book right now, which I'm really, really excited about. This is one that I've wanted to write for a really, really long time. And I'm pumped about it because I get to kind of lean into my academic background a little bit, not because it's an academic book, but just because being in academic spaces, I'm thinking about things on kind of a larger scale a lot of the time. So I'm going to be applying some of those things to issues in witchcraft. So that's what I'm currently writing. I'm very excited. Taurus Witch just came out. That is the second volume in Llewellyn's Sun Sign series, which is, they're really cute and they're jam packed with a lot of stuff. And there's going to be one book for each sun sign. And the idea is that as a member of a particular sun sign, you have certain tendencies and inclinations about you. And how do you harness that in a practice of witchcraft? So that was really, really fun to co-write. Ivo Dominguez Jr. Is a seasoned astrologer and he's really the powerhouse there, but he is co-writing with a witch from each sign.
Mm-hmm.
So as a Taurus, I got to write a whole lot about mental health and magic in the body and capitalism and finance and all kinds of really interesting stuff to me anyway. Fat phobia, yeah. Right? Like, I like to think that I provided the pragmatic stuff to his magic.
That's awesome. As a Taurus rising, I am appreciative.
Yeah. That's kind of the big thing. And then more doctor school. So I've got some academic projects that are related to witchcraft that I am wrapping up, and I'm hopefully going to start thinking about publishing those somewhere.
Awesome. All right. And people can find you where?
Pretty much everywhere except for Facebook. I use the handle Thorn the Witch. Thorn is Thorn. There's no E. Thorn the Witch on Instagram and TikTok. I run a Patreon where I do a lot of additional like blogging and posting, and it's a dollar. Everything is at the same level. So I try to be really accessible. And then I'm on Twitter as Tarot Skeptic. So, and you're welcome to ping me there if you have requests for academic articles. Provided I have the time, I'll help you.
There you go. Sounds like a plan. All right. So our last question is a tiny game of chance. And the joke is, as a Scorpio, I don't know how to do small talk. So depending on what number I roll, you'll get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money, which I think we've touched on all of these at some point. Except
that's
maybe
amazing.
Death.
As neurodivergent, I don't do small talk either.
Yeah, I'm not sure which one is actually the overriding reason I can't do small talk, but for anyone who actually gets my Substack newsletter today, which by the time they hear this will be have some time, is about podcasting and writing as a socially awkward person. So I'll roll and we'll see what we get. And if I roll a six, you get to pick which one you want. Three, religion.
Cool. Fate.
So you have mentioned on your YouTube, and I know in The Witch's Path, that you did not grow up in a Christian home. So you came to witchcraft without that particular set of baggage. So when you kind of stepped into a leadership role as a coven leader or in other leadership roles, has that been an advantage or disadvantage dealing with a lot of people who do have trauma and baggage around that?
It's both. It means that there's a lot of things that I can't relate to. Mm-hmm. And there's only so like I can be compassionate and empathetic, but I don't have a lot of the working knowledge or the tools, for example, to help somebody address something like trauma surrounding Christianity. Mm-hmm. And a lot of folks come in with that. And I've definitely gotten that kind of question and had to navigate those waters, because that's a common experience in magical spaces for sure. That's not a particular wound that I carry. So a lot of the times the best I can do is facilitate those conversations between other people, whether that's a coven mate or a therapist or just somebody else who's been there. And you know, being an ear, but I wouldn't presume to tell somebody like how to deal with that, because that's genuinely an experience that I don't have. The advantage is not having those kinds of experiences. I don't have a lot of hangups. And there's a lot of like hangups and kind of not even just hangups, but just perspectives that I think come from Protestantism in particular, that I think a lot of witches carry around, even if they don't otherwise deal with religious trauma. There's definitely certain kinds of like mores and ideas around things like sex and partnership or work and labor. Like one of the things that really kind of a button of mine is when witches will say that witchcraft is work. Witchcraft is work. And all I hear is the Protestant work ethic in that. I hear like Max Weber, and like that is the most Protestant thing I've like heard. Like, are you kidding me? The idea that labor is somehow holy, and by doing more work than other people, you're doing the thing that like you're somehow like more spiritual. Like that is a Christian wound right there. And of course, like when people say, well, witchcraft is work, what they mean is that it's going to take up a lot of your brain. It's going to take up your time. Like it's kind of an unconscious thing. Mm-hmm. But I can see a lot of those kinds of things, I think, whereas other people wouldn't. And it gives me more flexibility in what I can do as a coven leader, or how I can talk to other people, or what I think is possible versus what I think isn't possible. It's both. I'm always glad to have never been a Christian.
Well, I mean, I think about it because I did grow up kind of vaguely Christian. My parents weren't practicing. I mean, they both identified as Christian, but they weren't practicing. And then I went on this religious quest, right? And so I attended all kinds of different churches. And so I mostly just didn't, they didn't jibe with me. Like, I just never, but like, I really love German hymns because my father grew up in a Lutheran family. Yeah. So I tried that one, you know, and so I have these like some very positive feelings around some of the stuff that I still incorporate in my practice. I don't consider myself a Christian witch.
Yeah.
But I mean, they're not things I have a problem with. And so I always feel like I'm navigating this weird area with people who do have really deep wounds. Like, I don't want to accidentally trigger them, but I don't have the same feeling. So like, I try to be empathetic, but it is, like you said, I just don't have that. Though I have the vocabulary, I don't have the damage, I guess. So it's hard to navigate sometimes.
That's a situation that I think all of us deal with to some extent, whether it's, you know, one wound or another. And I think like that kind of collective healing is a joint effort, right? Like, I've got my baggage and you've got yours. We both need to work on our own baggage and be mindful of each other's baggage, but ultimately we're not responsible for each other's baggage.
Yeah. And I think that's the mature way to look at it. It's, you know.
Yeah. And I think religious combinations too are, I mean, that's something all of us do, whether or not we're like, there's no such thing as a pure tradition out there. Like, we're all like, we're all doing something weird based in our own experiences or perceptions or whatever. There's no like, you know, singularly pure thing where it's like, oh, well, if you've got a Christian background and you think Christianity is okay and you want to mix it into your witchcraft, that's a problem. But, you know, nobody else does that with, you know, their own, like the religions of their childhood or just, I don't know. It's, I think Christian witches in particular get shit on in a way that other religious combinations don't.
Yeah. Which too bad. I find it interesting because I'm like, well, you know, to me, those are people who've embraced the good things about Christianity that, you know, that feed their soul in whatever way, but also understand that there's more out there. Like, to me, that seems like, I don't know, in our current culture, a very potent mix in a person to be able to hold both those spaces.
So. Yeah. And that's a very American thing too. We like for people to only check one box at a time. It really bothers us when people don't fit neatly into boxes.
Yeah.
And we have really, we talk about religion like it's a singular thing and it's the same all over the world without realizing that the way we conceive of religion is very unique to the United States in particular. Mm-hmm. So like, Americans think that, well, like, religion is about what you believe and feel in your heart, and it impacts the rituals you do sometimes, but it could also just be about what you feel in your heart, what you believe. And it's always about morals and being afraid of death. And you get to check one box because religion provides you with a whole complete cosmology. So you shouldn't need anything else if you're doing it right. And like, nobody else thinks, like, that's not how that operates. Like, even here, that's not how that operates. But like, that's, we pretend that that's how we do it. Right.
So I think when we have more people who are witches in the like Eastern Christmas sense of witches, like Christians who are Easter and Christmas Christians, like, I think maybe that'll be interesting to see. Like, I think it happens already, but we don't hear a lot about it. But I know those people are out there. Like, I'm a witch on Beltane and Halloween. You know?
Yeah. I know an awful lot of people who identify as witchy. And I don't know if the use of that word, I don't say that to be disparaging, but I've just noticed that the word is different. People will say that they are witches, but some people will say that they are witchy. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's kind of getting at that. Like, when somebody says that they're witchy, like when that's in their, you know, their bank of adjectives for themselves. Like, I feel like I know a few things about them. I feel like I have a sense of their aesthetics. I have a sense of their politics. I have a sense of like I could comfortably make some guesses about what kind of media they like to consume, you know? But I wouldn't necessarily assume that they were actually doing rituals, right? Or like, you know, working with spirits or whatever. Like, so I think we're seeing that now. And to be clear, like, I don't have a problem with like witchiness.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know? I feel like I have enough on my plate that I don't need to comment what's on anybody else's, unless they are actively harming themselves or someone else. Go for it. That's
sure.
That's kind of my approach.
And even then there might be some leeway.
I don't need to get involved. I don't have to condone it. That's my other, you know, it's like, I don't need to get involved necessarily, but yeah, it's sad. Yeah. I think what you said about Americans and this approach to thing is just like really important to contextualize for people. And I don't think we do it very well, but I think it's really important to contextualize things that way.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well,
cool.
Thorne, thank you so much. I'm excited for what's coming for you. And this was fantastic and fun. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you indulging me chasing rabbit holes down things that, you know, folks don't usually ask me about.
Well, good. I would like to think we're doing something different a little bit. Anyway, it's good to have a niche, right? So.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well,
all right.
Let's talk again soon when you have a new book.
Absolutely.
Out.
Yeah. I'm around. Holler. I'll be helpful to you somehow someday, maybe.
Same.
All right. Awesome. Bye, Victoria.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shinekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.